We are starting this morning with some really interesting discussions, continuing on the theme of wider corporate reporting. And this time I am not going to steal Hugh's thunder and allow and request Hugh to do some introductions and as to how we fit in, you know, these presentations fit into the ISB's program, if you like, how we came to do it. But I guess I really would like to say welcome and thank you to the three of you for being here this morning.
Well, just a few brief words. I guess climate change or climate-related disclosure and other things really came firmly onto our agenda towards the end of last year when the Financial Stability Board organised a seminar. And out of that seminar, a task force has been established, this climate-related disclosures task force. And we've got two sessions today, and then there'll be some breakout discussions. So firstly, Richard Thorpe is going to present the official position, if you like, so the Financial Stability Board, where the Financial Stability Board is in all of this. And then I think really to open up our minds a little bit and to really start to think about what the issues might be in a broader sense and to get behind, a little bit peel the onion, if you like, on this. We have James Leeton and Mike Knight from Carbon Tracker. Now, Carbon Tracker is a think tank dedicated to thinking about climate risk. Well, they will explain it far better than I will, but that's essentially what they are. And Carbon Tracker, very high profile in this area. They were at that seminar, and they are all over this issue. So I think that will be a very interesting session to open up our thinking as to what this is all about. So with no further ado, I shall pass over to Richard, and he will outline the official position.
Good morning, everybody. It's now just over 3 years since I was ceased to be a member of this council. And at that time, I thought I was going to go off to the Financial Stability Board and work on accounting for financial instruments and disclosures and audit quality. I'm absolutely stunned to be sitting here now talking to you about climate change. I never thought that that would be relevant to my job. When we had, you may well be aware of the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force, which did some very good work for us on banks disclosures. When we had a conference call of that group and I explained what we were doing, one of the co-chairs stopped me and said, "I'm sorry, I think the line broke up. For a moment, I thought you said you were working on climate change." So we really are. And as you are members of the ISB, is a member of the Financial Stability Board, it's your fault that I'm doing this. So thank you for that. But I thought I'd start just in support of what Hugh was just saying, just explaining how we got to where we are. And as everything with us, it really starts with a request from the G20. So we had a request from the G20 last April to convene the round table that Hugh referred to, and that was held in September. And on the back of that, we came up with disclosures being the thing we should focus on. Now, when we met in September, we looked at a number of issues, including carbon pricing and others. And this was felt to be the issue that was most relevant to financial stability and was the one where we could most add some value. So that is why we're working on disclosure. And I'll take you through how all of this is working, how the process has built up, and give you some thoughts, unofficial thoughts, on where this is likely to go. It has to be unofficial because the whole point of setting up a private sector body is that I, as the public sector, don't influence it. If I were to, it would no longer be private sector. But I've got some idea of where it might like go, and I'll give you that on the understanding that you don't tell anybody or something like that. So we now have a task force. It was established in January. It is chaired by Mike Bloomberg from Bloomberg, and he has four vice chairs who are from a variety of backgrounds across the world. You can see the names on the list there. It's very useful, I think, to look at this in the context of the Enhanced Disclosures Task Force. That was, we think, a great success. And that was an example of the private sector preparers, users and auditors agreeing what they think the problem is and then designing disclosures that will address that problem. So that really is the precedent. This has to be something that depends, that is driven by the use of the needs of users. And we have a wide range of users on the group, and we also have that wide range of backgrounds. They had their first meeting in February. More meetings are planned. And as you'll see on the next slide, we are moving quite rapidly. Not the next slide, it's the one after that. Right, this is their mandate. Mandates from the FSB and from the G20 are very carefully crafted. So this is the language that is being used. And the key here, the thing that I'd like you to take away, is that we are looking for consistent, comparable, reliable, clear and efficient disclosures. Consistent and comparable. Those are always very difficult to deliver. And that is what we've asked them to look at. On the detail, some of the detail I'll pick up in some of the later slides. But another important element of this is who are the stakeholders in the process. And we have said specifically lenders, insurers, investors, and other stakeholders. That's quite a broad group, and of course other stakeholders is a bucket that we can throw anything into. But I'll come back to that later in the slides because that too is extremely important and highly relevant to the discussions you're going to have later today. The process. So when we met in September, it was already clear that this debate is not where the EDTF debate was in 2011, that there is much less clarity about what the needs are and much less clarity about how to address them. We don't have the sort of burning platform that existed in the banking sector at the time, which is why we agreed that we would do this in two stages. The first stage, to come up with the scope and objectives and report to us at the end of March, and the second stage, to develop and deliver some examples of good principles, some recommendations, and importantly, some examples of leading practice. We thought at the outset that the first task force would be about a dozen people. It's actually 22. And the reason for that is the need to have balance across the world and across industries. But there is still the prospect of an increase in size to around 30, and that's something that the FSB plenary will need to consider when it meets at the end of March. This is run by Bloomberg, so they are good at communications, and there's much more need to be public and transparent about this than there was in the EDTF. So they have a website, I've given you the address there, and I was told by my colleagues who are younger and more technically savvy than me that I should also mention they have a Twitter account. So good luck with that. If you feel the need to look at the Twitter account on climate disclosures, you can, and I've given you the address. They're already up and running. There is a great deal of energy in this group, a great deal of commitment. The first meeting was highly energetic, and there are already subgroups working to deliver some of the detail, and I'll come back to the timetable on the later slides. Right, when we reported to the G20 in November, we set out what we thought were the key risks, and there they are. Physical risks, liability risks, and transition risks. It's important, I think, to set this out very clearly because there is still misunderstandings even at the FSB. We are not talking here about disclosures by banks and insurers. We are to some extent, but we are talking primarily about disclosures by the entities in which they invest. So the very simple example, if you are an insurer and you invest in the oil sector, you need to have a pretty good understanding of what the risks are to those future cash flows that would derive from climate change and the opportunities in those future cash flows, depending on which industry you're in. And you need to understand how they can change as perceptions change. And this is, of course, exactly the sort of forward-looking disclosures that you're already starting to think about in the context of IFRS 9. That's why I mentioned an insurer. A bank making a loan should already be thinking about this without us doing extra work. So we're looking at disclosures by wider corporates and other investment vehicles. Banks will be in, but it's going to be a lesser part of the exercise, I think. Why do we need the consistency? 400 disclosure schemes or thereabouts, that's an approximate figure, but that's been referenced in Mark Carney's speech and was in the paper we produced. A whole range of NGOs. Within those disclosures, a wide range of scopes, objectives, a wide range of places to report. No consistency, no wide take-up on most of these. We're in the business of building on the existing initiatives. We don't want to start reinventing the wheel, coming up with something new. And we're also aware that many of these do not focus on those financial risks of climate change. Part of our mandate as the FSB is to coordinate the work of international regulators who are working on broadly the same subject. So it's consistent with that, as well as being, of course, a financial stability issue. If banks and insurers don't know what they're investing in and it goes wrong, then that can affect stability. The types of disclosure. As I said, we're at an early stage of this. But as I've said, I expect this to be risk to the business and I expect it to be forward-looking. A tentative decision is that this should be in the annual report. All of this is tentative. They've only had one meeting. But I think it's likely that they will recommend that these are disclosures in the annual report, probably in the MD&A. I'm an accountant. I like disclosures to be in the accounts because the auditors are on the hook then. But that's still to be determined. That will depend on whether it's qualitative or quantitative. Who are the stakeholders? We had an email exchange yesterday. I drew attention to the ISB's preface, which is pretty good on this, and it actually says specifically that the stakeholders in accounts are shareholders, creditors, employees, and the public at large. So I suspect that if we're saying this should be in the annual report, then we're going to be looking at a similar range of stakeholders. That won't change the information, but it will give a better idea for those who are preparing it. It's always useful to know who's going to be looking at it. We're looking at qualitative and quantitative disclosures. A lot of this is going to be qualitative because of the uncertainty. And just to remind you, the title of this group's been carefully chosen as well. The Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. These are climate-related. We're not talking here about global warming. We're talking about climate-related. We're not talking about carbon. There are a whole range of reasons why climate has become a major issue, and this is something that we believe there will be a general buy-in for. The EDTF, one of the strengths, one of the things that's most attracted people now that the EDTF is out there, the thing that's stuck, the thing that banks and users are continuing to use, is the tables that are in there. The EDTF has a lot of tables. It says when you provide information that's consistent with the accounting standards, it's helpful if it's in tabular format. I don't think that's something that reasonably accounting standard setters can be asked to do. And I mention it because when you're having your later debate, it's an interesting issue. Will that be where this comes out? I don't know. But I wouldn't be surprised. There's a great deal of interest in that from users. So first meeting in February. There's another meeting in a week or so in Singapore. At the beginning of that meeting in February, there was a really lively discussion with a wide range of stakeholders. There were 160 people in the room in Bloomberg's office in London, and a series of really good presentations. I expect that they will go for the same pattern in Singapore, so anyone who's from that part of the world, please do engage with them. If you think it would be useful to come along and present, they would be interested in it. They're meeting on the 8th and 9th of March. That will be the last meeting before that first report comes out. That will be with us on the 30th, 31st of March. That's when we have our plenary meeting. And then there will be public consultation on that first draft. Then they will start work on the second report. They will work through the balance of the year and report back to the FSB towards the end of 2016, depending on the timing of meetings, with a view to having the final report out. If you're from Australia or maybe New Zealand, you could be the first users of this for June 2017 year ends. You can get there first. The sun rises first in that part of the world. So I would encourage Australian and New Zealand corporates to get out there and deliver on this early. Some big final points to make. First, please do engage with this if you think it's of interest to you. Please do look at their website. Please do offer comments. The people around this table are exactly the groups that would be helpful to have used from. Couple of pleas for the ISB. First, please fix IFRS 6. We now need that. I'm exaggerating, but only a little. I think that there will be increasing focus on accounting for extractive industries on the back of this. And IFRS 6 is one of the older standards on the book. So I think that will become an increasing focus as these reports come out. I think that you can expect people to be saying, we've got the disclosures right, the measurement needs to catch up. And generally, I think that the Financial Stability Board, one of the things the FSB does is we scan the horizon for risks. We look out there and try to identify risks to financial stability. We have people that do that and a couple of really good committees. As they find those risks, the traditional view would have been, how do we change the risk ratings? How do we change the Pillar 2 capital calculations? What do we do about operational risk? I don't think that there's any more an appetite to increase capital requirements. So I think you'll be seeing increasingly that as risks are identified, the FSB will see transparency and disclosure as a mitigant to that risk. The Enhanced Disclosure Task Force worked very well. That's been hugely successful. This is a second go. I can see one or two other issues coming on the horizon. So again, when you're talking later today, how is that going to work? Is it appropriate for that sort of information to be in annual reports? Again, personal bias, I think it is. I think that's where people look. Where would it go? How would you do it? Is it part of the existing suite of standards? Can disclosures be used to support those? It's just an interesting wider issue. And that's where we are so far. I could say a lot more, but I'm not supposed to. So I'll stop there.
Richard, thank you very much for that. I'm not sure if I speak for everybody, but I certainly found that fascinating and opened my thinking around, you think about, as you say, climate change and the disclosures around climate change itself, but the key implications, as Hugh has said, for us in terms of it's actually the financial risks around that on the impact on the cash flows. So I certainly have some questions and some comments, and I'm sure others do. However, I am actually going to ask James and Mike, I think that's probably best to do their presentation first, and then we'll open up for discussion. But thank you very much. So, James and Mike.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak today. As mentioned, Carbon Tracker's a non-profit think tank looking at the implications of the energy transition, particularly working with investors. I'm just going to take you on a quick run through some of the background research we've done in this area. And then my colleague Mike will pick up on some of the questions that may be relevant for the accounting industry. In terms of what Richard mentioned, I'm going to focus on the transition risk and the forward-looking issues that raises. I guess we try and do a lot of our work just using the basic numbers, the sort of global maths, if you like, of carbon and energy and emissions. So this is something that the IEA produced, sort of echoing our work around carbon budgets. So like any budget, you have a finite amount that you can use within a given period. So for this carbon budget, you can see the yellow sort of shaded area. It's yellow on my screen anyway, green maybe on there. The shaded area is the total amount of fossil fuels in the ground, the reserves and resources sitting in the ground. Where the blue line goes up to is essentially the policies that have already been announced that are coming through, if those are applied, where, you know, how much you could use from those resources. The green level is if you wanted to limit to the agreed target of limiting global warming to 2 degrees, the amount you could use. So as you can see, there's a clear overhang already in terms of the amount that we could burn, and coal on the left-hand side is the most effective. We did an exercise a few years ago mapping out where different companies had exposure to this and where they were listed, which stock exchanges. So you can see that London and New York, as you might expect, have a history of raising capital for the extractive sector. So you've got a significant amount of coal in the sort of brown colour in London and more of an oil focus in New York. And if they continue business as usual in terms of the companies listed there, that would sort of take us over the limit as well. So just to bring those numbers together, the amount we calculated would be emitted over the period to 2050 was 762 gigatons of CO2. the total sort of carbon budget, if you like, to that for that period is 900, but the 762 only includes the listed portion of the reserves and resources. So you've still got all the state-owned enterprises as well that want their share of the pie. So essentially, you could easily double that amount that's out there that would be burnt if you continued business as usual. So there's a clear sort of crunch point coming. Obviously, the question that we get from investors is then, well, who are the winners and losers? Who gets to burn their reserves? Who fits within that budget? I think just to pick up on why this is relevant in a financial sense, we're sort of trying to play it back from the right-hand side here, that if there isn't as much demand for your product, if there's a limit on emissions on the right-hand side, how does that play back through in terms of your earnings going forward, in terms of your need to spend capital on developing more assets, your ability to maintain your dividend, as we've seen from some companies already this year, that's proving to be a bit more challenging to maintain dividend levels. And obviously, particularly in the mining sector, there's a question about ability to service debt as well. So one way we've found of sort of identifying who the winners and losers might be is to use supply cost curves. So essentially, you're lining up all the projects over the next couple of decades that could be done by the extractive companies and saying, well, using sort of a basic economic logic, you would assume the cheapest ones would go ahead. Most of those actually are owned by the state-owned companies, so they have a lot of the cheapest supply, for example, oil in the Middle East, which then actually shifts more of the risk onto the private sector rather than the sort of basic assumption that it's an equal split. I'm just going to run through quickly a few bits of our research. Sort of reports that we've done are flagged in the slides, so if there's a particular one that's of interest to you, you can go and have a look. But so we've done some work around demand. So I guess the key thing here is the dotted line at the top of the first yellow section shows where current level of fossil fuel supply is. If you look at some of the scenarios of the companies, the oil majors, they all see sort of absolute growth in demand for their products and the overall energy demand picture getting bigger. If you look at the right-hand side of where we need to get to, you'll see that demand has actually got smaller. So you've got this divergence of views. Is this a growth industry or does it have to get smaller? It's not just about policy, it's also about technology. So we've done work around how quickly technology is coming through, and that's much faster than analysts and, well, particularly some of the governments are predicting. We've thought about what this means for some of the business models. So I think there's a question here about what is the default scenario you should be using. Is it business as usual? Is it a 2-degree scenario, given that's what governments have committed to? Is it somewhere in between? Is it a sensitivity analysis of what those mean for your business going forward? There's a range of reasons why we feel there is it's not valid to just use business as usual, because we see change coming, whether it's slower growth in China, air quality measures, carbon measures, improving efficiency. So I think this is where we're just seeing this, again, a divergence of views, and that's a real challenge for how you deal with this. You know, if a company is saying, we think that the graph is going up, and the world's governments are saying, no, this line has to go down, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that difference in views? So we've looked at various sectors, the US coal mining sector, Canadian oil sands, US shale, and EU utilities. You can dive into the detail if you want, but I think the key thing there is we're already seeing some of these issues coming through. You're already seeing value being destroyed. So the question really is there a better way of capturing that picture earlier, getting better information out there? And our latest piece sort of revisited, again, how much capital should be spent to fit within the 2-degree scenario, and I've identified $2 trillion of capex over the next decade that you wouldn't need to spend to be aligned with the 2-degree scenario. So there's this potential for a misread from the industry if they continue on business as usual. And there's, a geographic element again as well in terms of where this these resources are based. So this shows where the resources and the potential capital would be deployed that wouldn't be needed in a 2-degree scenario. So you can see it sort of spreads across North America, Asia, and again, there's probably an opportunity in Australia, as Richard said. But I'll pass over to Mike now.
Thanks, James. So what I think I'm merely going to do is to run fairly quickly through some questions that the council might find useful in sort of turning its mind to this issue. In fact, the breakout sessions this morning may realise that there are different or added questions that it would like to consider. But these are really questions set out on the slides, but I'll sort of run through these quite quickly. So in terms of what is currently being presented today, how have climate targets and technological change been incorporated into long-term company demand and price assumptions? I guess both in terms of quantitative and qualitative information. How have changes in economic growth, energy intensity and carbon intensity been factored in? There's quite a bit of M&A activity out there at the moment. So with the world of low commodity prices, are values needing to be more, asset values needing to be more visible? I guess in some ways that's a live debate. In the world of the carbon budget that James has set out, so the limitations on burning fossil fuels to a 2-degree limit, how does this impact the world of exploration and evaluation costs and activities? How is any limitation being disclosed in the balance sheet? Any limits on capitalising E&E, how does this get reflected in the context of the carbon budget? How should goodwill be adjusted for any changes to demand in key products? Does the carbon budget also have implications in other areas? So for instance, potentially bringing decommissioning costs forward. And likewise in the sort of, in the general world of impairments, if we're sort of working at a fair value level, how best do we include the variation of cash flows and mine volumes under low demand scenarios? Is this almost something akin to a sort of 2-degree stress test? The world of uncertainty and volatility associated with shifts and markets, does this sort of create a fossil fuel risk premium? Are the time horizons imposed on forecasts sufficient to incorporate some of the long-term considerations in this environment? And this is some of the challenges that the disclosure task force that Richard outlined is facing. And then finally, just in the world of sort of financial reporting, corporate reporting more generally, if we sort of think of an example of pension liabilities not having needed to have been addressed and then suddenly it became a sort of pressing issue, is this an opportunity for us to sort of get somewhat on the front foot to be able to consider within the climate in the world of financial reporting? There are other forms of information that go out to the market. So for instance, the world of mineral reporting. The SEC has certain requirements, and in Europe under the Prospectus Directive, there are also certain requirements to produce mineral competent persons reporting. How does that link back into this world of disclosure of climate and carbon? Does the narrative reporting aspects and financial data align and provide an overall sense of how a company is or isn't in line with any climate constraints? And then finally, what else might be required to give a true and fair view? So is this really a discussion about, I think as Richard said, are there current standards in place that need to be applied in a different way? Or are we really talking about creating some sort of new set of standards to be able to to accommodate the considerations here. So, a number of questions. I guess we're sort of in your hands as to how we play this from here.
Thank you very much, Mike and James. I think, as you say, a number of questions, and I think some very provocative questions that you have raised there. As indicated, we are effectively, we now have 15 minutes with sitting around the table with the three of individuals here before we move into breakout sessions, and Hugh will give a little bit of introduction before we move there in terms of the objective of those breakout sessions. But essentially it is to have heard, you know, what we've heard this morning and the discussions last night, and think about some key questions around the future of or financial reporting and how these things can impact that. So we've got about 15 minutes with these three here, really to probe any further, ask some questions, follow up. So I am in your hands, and Andrew, you have been quick off the mark.
Is that working? Yeah. I just wanted to respond really on the starting with the topic of auditors. And I think we have a vested interest, because we would like, I would like every company to put this data in their annual reports, and we would like to provide assurance reports. But it's quite clear, I think there's experience has been in the UK, you know, we've had quite a lot of growth in this area over a number of years. But there's a question that starts with, do you mandate this disclosure? Do you encourage it? Because I think companies only do it because either they have to or because there is a business imperative. And we've had various bits of additional disclosure have come through which have been mandated that everyone's done. And the rest tends to be only when they have a business imperative or where they're in a sector that really requires it. The other thing I'd say is that the quality of the data in this area is really just not up to the standard yet to be audited. I think we, in many cases, we issue assurance reports. I've indeed signed an assurance report from one company, but it really is from a set of systems and a set of data which is really not yet at a standard in many cases to be audited. So I think those are my sort of two points I'd raise. One is the question of mandating or a question of encouragement, and the other is a question of whether the data is yet good enough in many cases to actually get some form of audit opinion.
Do any of you want to respond to that or just absorb that at this point?
Very happy to respond on the mandatory or voluntary issue, because clearly we have asked this group to produce some voluntary disclosures. And the reasons that we've done that are similar to the reasons that apply to the Enhanced Disclosures Task Force. If you are standard setters to produce a suite of disclosures, they will produce a suite of disclosures and they will go through a full due process and those will be applied, but they tend to become ossified. That's true of all of us, true here, true when I was at the FSA, because it takes time to change things. The advantage of having something that's driven by the private sector is that it will evolve as needs change, but it only works if people actually apply it. And as soon as you start enforcing voluntary disclosures, they turn into rules with all of the problems that have followed from that. Now, we have something like 80% application of the EDTF across the banking sector, but it's a much more homogeneous sector than the one we're looking at here. We will make recommendations to the G20. It's up to them to decide what they do with that. But I think mandatory disclosures are challenging. On the issue of auditing, I mean, is it early in the day to be provocative? So if you can't audit the numbers, what are the banks going to do when they base their expected loss provisioning on those numbers?
Okay, that'll do in terms of, it's a very good question, but I'm not at this stage think it's appropriate to have auditors argue. And we'll come back perhaps, and maybe that's actually something that happens in the breakout session around the voluntary versus mandatory disclosures and thinking about standards. I had Lothar next on my list.
Thank you. Firstly, I think the report, the analysis, I liked very much. I think it's extremely relevant to investors to look at. And sorry about this. I had actually set up an ESG research team in my bank, and this is exactly the type of analysis which is important and needs to be looked at. However, coming to the point of preparers actually reporting on these things, which is something different. You mentioned, as an example, the pension liability reporting. And I could add, for instance, the recent example in Germany, the utilities, where you have provisions for the decommissioning and what do you call that, rebuilding, like destroying of the atomic reactors, which were too low, and now there's a big fight of how much the companies will actually have to pay for that, and the valuation of the companies broke down dramatically, RWE and E.ON. Now, those are things which are actual obligations of the companies, which were maybe not reported or misjudged. The things we're talking about here, implications of climate change, to me seem more like a regulatory risk, because you'll have taxation or restrictions on using your assets or whatever, which may come up in the future, but it's a different category of risk, and I really don't see at this point how that could be reported in a way that it would be in the actual kind of normal financial reporting. And I can see how the auditors say, sorry, this is something we cannot verify and put a stamp on and say that's all guaranteed. So that's really my problem. Yes, analysis and looking into these issues, very clear, but how should preparers really report on that? I don't see that so much.
And perhaps that's something that might come out of the breakout discussions, but useful thoughts. Alan?
Yes, just a congratulations to the FSB for trying to tackle this. With an Australian perspective on this, it is very, very difficult and very various in terms of its application, not just across industries, but within industries across, say, coal, oil, even within the energy industry. I attended, for my own education in Australia, a course where they were going to educate us on how we could assist the government in bringing in some of these carbon tracking, carbon reporting issues, and I came away with a volume like that and needing another engineering degree or something similar. Very, very difficult, congratulations. But the thing I want to draw attention to is the time-bound factor. We don't have time. There isn't time. So I don't think it can ever be mandatory disclosure, because by the time you do develop all the standards that go behind mandatory disclosure, the time will have passed. So voluntary, yes, but there are ways of introducing voluntary disclosure. In Australia, they just asked each of the companies to tell them what their carbon footprint was. That's it. So everybody did. Everyone was good-hearted Charlie and did that, provided that information. And then the next thing was, well, next year you want to tell us how you intend to reduce your carbon footprint. So we all did that too. We're all very cooperative. And then the third year it came, now tell us how you're going to reduce your carbon footprint by X percent. And so everybody became increasingly both educated and focused over that time. So I think that's really congratulations to tackling the issue, but it's not easy.
Thanks, Anne. Alan.
Thanks. Richard, question for you about, given this is Financial Stability Board, there are sort of two aspects to this. Either the motivation is to try and understand how entities are contributing to climate change or how they're actually being affected by it. And I think that that's a Lotus point. That's the harder one to manage. But in an extreme, or the simple, I think you can find it much simpler to say, what's my carbon footprint? But I think, given it's a Financial Stability Board, looking at this, are they more interested in sort of systemic risk as associated with that, which thing, you know, it's the simplest example that I've been given is, say, when you have a just-in-time inventory system, but you find that there are more cyclones emerging in a particular area, so it gets disrupted, so you're much more at risk. Do you sense that it's more about the contribution they're making to this, and hence behavioural change, or managing the risk, which is the other extreme?
It's a fair question. It's difficult to answer because they are at an early stage. So that first scope paper will help to set that out. That's why I said at the beginning, what I can say categorically is that we're looking here at the risks to the business, to BP, to Unilever, to BHP Billiton. Unilever and BHP Billiton are both members of this task force. The risk to their business from climate change. And there are a whole range of players in that risk. As others have said, some of this will be regulatory requirements, you know, if they're required to keep to 2 degrees. Some of it will be the actual effect of climate change. Some will be the way their customers change their behaviours. All of that is in play at the moment, but it's got to be narrowed down or we won't get something that we can deliver by the end of the year.
Okay. Mary.
I think I'd like to just check my understanding of the implications of some of the carbon budget, EE costs, impairment carbon budgeting slides. And it seems to me, as I reflect on the challenges here, that many of those are challenges. Sorry, I'm trying to figure out who they're directed at. And I was trying to parse out whether they're directed at, for example, the ISB as a standard setter in terms of changing accounting or disclosure requirements, or whether they're a challenge, and it's more an awareness-raising challenge, to people applying the current standards. And I think there's a mix in here, but I'd be interested in some views, because if I look at some of the challenges on, for example, impairments in carbon budget, do fair value determinations address, you know, da-da-da-da-da, I think the challenge you're really raising is, are companies realistic, from your perspective, in their expectations of what the future looks like? And you're trying to raise awareness about alternative future scenarios that impact accounting for recognized assets, recognized liabilities today, kind of Lotho's point about was there enough anticipation of what actual costs were, while some of the other items might be think again, ISB, about your exploration and evaluation activities standard and what the hurdles should be. And just ask you for some comments about whether you're more focused on changing behavior within, you know, and expectations within the current framework, or whether you're looking at changes in financial reporting.
Very good question, Mary. Mike, are you able to make any comments around that, given that they were your questions?
Absolutely valid questions. And I think, I guess from a climate change NGO's perspective, what we're trying to get the world focused on, and the world in a very broad sense focused on, is the challenges of meeting climate targets. And what I think we're seeing is a sort of complete divergence in some fossil fuel companies' beliefs and expectations put out either via regulatory filings and regulatory statements or just the very sort of media statements that they make, and the world of 2-degree-like and Paris Agreement-like climate constraints. How do you resolve that? How do you resolve that? What seems to be quite a fundamental divergence or dichotomy is probably not a single answer or a simple solution. But I guess the very reason for sitting in front of a financial reporting community today is to raise the awareness of some of the technicalities and the fundamentals of the issue, question what is the role of financial reporting in trying to resolve that really quite almost sort of an existential dichotomy? Is it a question of financial reporting community plays a role in dressing or changing or influencing company behaviour, quite possibly? Is it something where the financial reporting community has a role to play in getting investors more on the page and in the picture as to what the risks are, arguably? Is this a... I think I'm sort of... I would throw it back to the group, and this is probably the topic for the breakout this morning. Is this a case of taking something that exists and applying it in a different way and challenging some of the notions in the way that it's being applied today, versus is something new, does something new require to be created? So I think we fully recognise some of the challenges here. Not sure whether we as yet have a solution, and really wanting to engage in some useful discussions with people like the financial reporting community as to how we do try and collectively find a solution. And I think Richard's experience in and around the Disclosure Task Force also demonstrates how challenging some of the solution and the thinkings are here.
Thanks for that response, and I think between the two of you, you've certainly, if you like, made what some of the discussion for the breakout around that precise question. Philippe, just before we break.
Yeah, thank you. I will be very brief. In the presentations, none of you had mentioned so far the COP21 conference and the outcome of that conference, the so-called Paris Agreement. You just mentioned it. Now, I'm not sure how that changes the whole picture in terms of the timing of the impact on the economy and on the companies that might be concerned, because if I got it right, if governments are serious in implementing the agreement, there will be a reduction in the amount of carbon emissions by each government to be managed, and then they will have to allocate this amount of reductions among companies, among participants in the economy. I don't know what exactly the timing will be, but when that will become clearer, then companies will have a better understanding of how they will be impacted in terms of how much they will have to achieve in carbon reductions. And this is maybe the time when really the impairment will have to be taken into account, because some companies will have to impair their assets or will have to stop developing certain projects which they had in mind. But when is the timing? I mean, this is what I don't see. I see the theoretical point. All that is very good. I don't see how it does affect us as standard setters and how we should build that into our own standards.
Thanks. I mean, I think the Paris Agreement confirms the direction of travel. I think there is still a fundamental question in terms of a reasonable assumption of what people's business are going to look like forward. And I would distinguish between this kind of fundamental business strategy demand for their products versus the carbon footprinting. I mean, I think also it doesn't have to be a negative thing. So there will be companies that will be better off in this 2-degree scenario, so battery producers and so on. So I think there's also a consistency element that if a battery producer is saying, our business is going to grow, it's going to be great, you know, in 5 years' time, and the sort of competitor on the carbon intensive side is saying our business is going to grow and be great as well, they can't both be right. So what's the reasonable probability of those scenarios?
Okay, thank you. And sorry, Vincent, I didn't see your flag. So the last question.
It's a question for Richard. Richard, as I understand, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, which has been in place since 2013, has the objective of developing investor-relevant, sector-specific climate change-related disclosures, and this inform on financial impacts, including liabilities and impacts on revenues and costs as well. And as I understand, these disclosures are also voluntary in nature rather than mandated. Obviously, they're US-focused, and when you consider that Michael Bloomberg is involved both with the SASB and with the Financial Stability Board, could you perhaps comment on whether there are any other differentiating factors between the work of the two respective organizations?
You're quite right. SASB is a key player here, and Mike Bloomberg is involved in both. Mary Shapiro is also an advisor to the seed, our group, and is heavily involved in SASB. And I think already in discussions it's become clear that as we look across the horizon, those standards will be a major element of the work that the task force does. Many of them are currently key performance indicators rather than disclosures that describe the potential effects on cash flows, but that will become clear. But look, there are a lot of initiatives. That's one of the better known ones. There are others. They're all in play.
Okay, thank you. And I didn't know of the existence of that board, which probably shows my ignorance. But I think that's... Okay, but I think that is actually quite relevant to some of the discussions. Now, Hugh, in terms of we're going to break into the breakout sessions, you've put a paper together. Do you want to give a brief overview of that paper that you've put in terms of the breakout questions and where you want us to focus? Because I've certainly had a number of comments from people that there seem to be an awful lot of questions to cover.
We also discussed it, yeah. So agenda paper, which is listed as agenda reference 6/7, on the second page of that, there are these breakout questions 1, 2, and 3. I think based on, and really the first two are in relation to the fee paper on corporate reporting, and the third question is a more generic question related to the presentations we've just had. Based on the discussions yesterday, I think there was a lot of folks wanting to emphasise how would you take the fee paper forward from a policy perspective, if you like. So I think what would make sense, given there are a lot of questions, is to ignore completely question one and to focus just on questions 2 and 3, and that will make sure you have a manageable number of questions and that hopefully we get some practical suggestions coming out of the breakout groups. So it's the same breakout groups as yesterday, and we have until 11:30.